Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Rick Carlin, the brilliant Capital Bureau reporter for the Albany Times-Union, a reform ski bum. He has previously covered education, consumer affairs, and features at the Times-Union. Welcome, Rick Carlin.
How are you, Alan?
Well, it's great to have you here. The legislature has come and gone. The governor has taken great credit for an extraordinary session. The New York Times, one of your competitive newspapers, had an editorial this morning saying, not so fast,
not so
governor.
Much.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I think
they
used the word ridiculous to make that claim. So let's start out by an overview. What are people saying about this session?
Well, really, the session, in a lot of ways, much of it concluded on April 1st when the budget was passed. That's when a lot of the really big ticket items were approved. The move towards the $15 minimum wage, Family Leave Act. They basically refunded the schools. They caught up a lot of the school spending with the cuts that really dated back to 2008. All of that was done in the budget, and that's been the governor's modus operandi now. If he has something that's really top priority, must do items, he puts it in the budget because he knows that the lawmakers feel like they cannot vote against the budget. Then they have to go home and explain to their constituents and to their political opponents in November, why did you vote against school funding? Well, did they really? No, they just voted against a massive budget bill that had literally dozens of items tucked in there, which none of them read anyway. But he knows that. He knows that they can't be late on the budget, or they feel like they can't be late on the budget.
So when the governor makes these claims, is anybody listening? Does anybody care?
Well, you know, we in the press we have a gimlet eye towards this. We're all acutely,
a gimlet is a drink?
A little wary of it. We're acutely wary of the ethics failings of this session. They really, you know, they did a couple things with some ethics. They did start the move towards pension forfeiture for elected officials and policymakers if they're convicted of a crime, a felonious crime. If this is passed in the constitutional amendment, they could lose their pensions. So that was
not
done.
They couldn't, because those people don't think they're ever going to get arrested and indicted for stealing.
So if they do.
And I thought in one of the most hypocritical things I've ever seen, as you just pointed out, you got to wait two years to get this thing
through. It's going to be a good 2 years. It has to be passed again by another legislature.
Sure.
Then it has to go before the voters for a constitutional amendment. Because as you know, public pensions are constitutionally protected. They cannot be, quote unquote, diminished in any way. So it's going to be at least 2 years before that's in place.
But in the meantime, the things that they could have done, things like the United States Congress has limiting outside income.
Right.
They just wanted no part of it whatsoever. And that governor didn't want to help them get it done.
He really didn't. He didn't really relish that fight. He didn't really have the stomach it just wasn't his top priority. I think that part of it, to be very cynical, comes down to the internal polling that all these politicians do, both parties, the Senate Republicans, the Assembly Dems, and the governor. They all do their own polling. And I'm pretty sure this is not necessarily the top of the list for most voters. They're not going to the polls voting for or against their assemblyman or assemblywoman, looking at how they voted or didn't vote on an ethics bill that maybe did or didn't even come to the floor for a vote. They're looking at, did they bring home money for the schools? Have their taxes stayed stable? Are the roads being fixed? Those sort of prosaic items. So they know that they know they can get away with this, frankly. I hate to say it, because they do. They, you know, what's the reelection rate? It's very high among assembly members and Senate members.
Well, not only that, when we go on with our Vox Pop program where people call in, you mentioned Trump and every light goes on. Whomp!
Yeah.
You mentioned the state legislature and ethics. You got to beg them to call.
Yeah. So it gets arcane. And when you're talking about ethics boards, you're getting very high priced, you know, $400 an hour lawyers. They're very good at muddying the waters and making it, it becomes very confusing, very technical. All of a sudden you're talking about some issue that's way off track rather than did this guy or didn't this person commit a crime? And we see it over and over again. We see it in the state ethics panel, the J-COPE, as it's called.
J-JOKE.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Rick Carlin, as we get into this, there is some dark music in the background, and it is provided courtesy of the U.S. attorney, Preet Bharara, who is looking very, very closely at the two former top aides of Governor Cuomo.
Correct.
And he's being strangely silent, I think, during this time.
The governor is Preet Bharara.
No, the governor, because people expect that the shoe is going to fall and that somebody is going to get indicted.
That, I think that's a fair expectation. I mean, as you know, this relates to a lot of the upstate economic development initiatives that the governor has put forth, including the so-called Buffalo Billion, where the state is pumping $1 billion in an effort to revive the Buffalo economy. There's a lot of questions about how the bids have been let. There's also questions that the Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, is looking into regarding some of the bids here in Albany at the SUNY Poly, which is part of SUNY. It's the new tech institute.
Run by a very close Cuomo associate, Elaine Calieros.
Yes, yeah, Elaine Calieros is really the...
Previously considered an untouchable.
Well, yeah, he basically created SUNY Poly. He's a nanotechnology expert. He's well known in his field. He's been close to all of the governors, though, because he's been seen as a rainmaker. He convinced IBM, Tokyo Electric, other big semiconductor companies to join in this effort where the state builds the facility, and then these companies come in and they conduct experiments and try to develop the next generation of computer chip. So it's worked out well here in Albany. The question now is, has there been some funny business with some of the offshoots in Buffalo, maybe in Utica?
Maybe here in Albany.
And maybe here in Albany as well, regarding a dormitory that they were going to build, which apparently appears to be at least on hold to some extent, because the AG is looking into that one.
So for our listeners, they have to know that a lot of this is whether there was pay-to-play involved in all this, right?
Pay-to-play. You must give to get. That's the saying that we've always heard in Albany. Companies, whether they're contractors or law firms or bonding companies, they give enormous contributions to the politicians, including the governor. They can often get around the limits by creating LLCs or limited liability corporations. There's no limits on how many of those corporations you can create. You can create a series of these corporations. Rick Carlin 1, Rick Carlin 2, Rick Carlin 3, 4, 5. Give lots of money to the candidate of your choice, then the expectation becomes, oh, you get the bid to put up the new building or to get the legal work or to sell the bonds, et cetera. You know, the state is basically a fountain of money. And the people that get the biggest piece of this fountain are often major political donors. And that's really what Preet Bharara is looking into. Can he draw a connection between the donors and the jobs that the donors or the donors' principals are getting? It's not easy. You have to prove that there's a quid pro quo. You have to prove that someone said, if you donate money, you will get this job. These guys are way too smart to say that. But although Dean Skelos was not too smart.
Not only
to say
Dean Skelos,
so,
but Shelley Silver.
Yeah,
there was a quid pro quo announced. And by the way, the Supreme Court is about to come out with yet another judgment, which may in fact make it much easier for both Skelos and Silver to get off if the theft of honest services is held too broad, which they've done before.
And that's happened already once.
Yes.
And we saw that with Joe Bruno, where he was convicted and then he was acquitted. He was the Senate majority leader here from the Capital Region. It was honest services, but the initial version of that bill was deemed to be too broad by the Supreme Court, and it was thrown out. On the second trial, I remember the federal prosecutors were saying, or at least the first time, they were saying, we're not trying to prove a quid pro quo here. It gets into tangential issues like appearances, disclosure, and things of that nature.
Well, let me go back to this guy Calieros again for a moment. He had positions throughout this whole thing.
Sure.
This is the guy from SUNY Poly, and he resigned from a couple of those positions. What was that all about, Rick?
Well, I think that what's happening as the scrutiny is getting closer, the scrutiny is bearing down on them, they think that maybe they better just separate themselves. He better separate himself a bit from some of these corporations that have been set up to actually enact the contracts to put up the dorms and the buildings. And he had been running, he had really been running everything for a while.
Didn't that look bad?
And I think it was a matter of appearances. He might have been advised by legal counsel, I don't know, that maybe you should step back and this will, at least the appearance won't be so bad and they won't have as much to look at the present time. So,
well,
yeah.
Well, Rick Carlin, somebody wrote that the governor, who is now surrounded, he has these two guys around him which are weighing him down,
yeah,
who we know are being looked at very carefully, his two former closest aides. We read some people who are saying that the governor's trying to set Calieros up as the bad guy. Is that possible?
I wouldn't say it's impossible. I mean, I think that the cards will land where they will. You know, the governor is a smart guy.
He's
probably way too smart to have been caught saying anything like, give me this and I'll give you that. He's known, we know, in the Capitol, he does not use email, which eliminates one potential trace. And he's just looking to see, did he go too far with the pay-to-play, or did he do a pay-to-play? And then the question was, did he do a pay-to-play deal at someone's bidding, at the governor's bidding, or Todd Howe's bidding? Or did he just do it thinking that that was okay? This we don't know yet.
A lot of people, Rick Carlin, are speculating in Albany.
There's a lot of speculation.
Right, as to whether or not Andrew Cuomo himself is in any legal danger. I agree with you. I mean, I think he's a sharp guy.
Yeah.
If anybody's doing anything, it's his aides and not him. And that would mean this is pure speculation, mm-hmm. but this is what people are talking about. Then the question is, does a Todd Howe or one of the other guys turn on the governor and say, he told me something, in order so that
right.
they don't have to go to prison?
Right, or they get a lightened sentence. I mean, there's two things. Joe Prococo goes way back with the Cuomo family. He worked with Mario Cuomo and Andrew Cuomo, described as a third son. Sort of the common wisdom is that he would take the fall just out of loyalty.
Right. That's what
Prococo does. If he had to go to jail, go to prison. Todd Howe goes way back. I don't know that he's quite as close. He's sort of been in the circle, but he's done other things as well. He's had apparently a lot of financial problems in his own personal finances, including all sorts of bankruptcies and unpaid bills and so forth. So he might be liable to sing, as it were. The Elaine Calieros could be the wild card here. He's a guy who is known to be a bit unpredictable in what he says. He's a very colorful fellow. And, you know, who knows what he's telling the federal investigators? And are they believing him?
Are there tea leaves here which indicate whether Andrew Cuomo is the session setting himself up to run for a third time?
He earlier, back during the budget, when they were closing the budget, said that he was planning to run for a third term. So at this point, I would assume probably yes. I don't know that it's a 99% surety, but I suspect he will run for a third term. At least that's what he has said the last time that it came up. You know, and the other thing is, right now, today, he'd probably still get reelected. And the question is, who's out there who could challenge him? You know what? You know, we're in a heavily Democratic state. He's really gotten control of the Democratic Party, of the apparatus. There's a lot of Dems that don't like his hardball tactics, but they've sort of gone along. There's no one out there that we see right now who could really mount a real challenge. The Republicans, they don't have enough voters. They don't have any money. Cuomo has a very large war chest, so I think he's in good shape.
What kind of grade would you give to Speaker Carl Hastie, the new Assembly Speaker who moved in after Shelley Silver was being sentenced to jail?
Yeah, I'd give him a solid B. Yeah, about that. I don't think he gets an A because he didn't push hard enough on the ethics. I think he could have done more to help push that through, at least although he would have hit a roadblock in the Senate. I understand that. But he has, from what I'm hearing from members, he has opened up the process more in the Assembly. It's less dictatorial than it was under Shelley Silver. And now that Shelley Silver's gone, you start hearing the resentment that people had, that Silver had a death grip on everything. Nothing moved without him. Hastie seems to be a little bit more open in some ways, not in all ways. I mean, there was a lot of concern about the Hoosick Falls, the lack of hearings in both the Senate and the Assembly.
And that's over water.
This was a water contamination crisis in the village of Hoosick Falls, Rensselaer County. The state supposedly, you know, they dragged their feet in responding. A lot of people say, why did they drag their feet? They want hearings. The narrative is that the governor really doesn't want the hearings. He just wants to move on. He gave Hasty everything they wanted in the budget. Hasty at one point said this is a dream budget. And as a result, they kind of went along, okay, no hearings. So Hasty is not, he's not perfect, but he has opened up the process a lot more. People seem to like him. They don't dislike him. They're not fearful of him like they were of Shelley Silver. So I give him a B.
Hasty was the boss of the Bronx before he became the speaker, which is why I call him Boss Hasty.
Yeah.
So my question would be, do you see any of the, you know, sort of Democratic boss types from a county like the Bronx showing itself in the Assembly?
I'll give you an example. Friday night, they agreed to the Senate Republicans, which really, they really dislike Mayor de Blasio because Mayor de Blasio tried to knock them out in 14. They extended mayoral control of the schools in New York City by only 1 year.
One stinking year.
Thank you. With some strings attached that make a lot of disclosure for de Blasio. They didn't do any favors for de Blasio. The idea is Hasty went along with that. The Bronx machine, that's Ruben Diaz Jr.'s turf.
Mm-hmm.
And him and de Blasio don't get along so much.
Is it Diaz being talked about? Is that the father
potential,
or the son?
Yeah, he's the son.
But is the son being talked about as a potential?
It's come up as a potential mayoral candidate. Yeah, that's come up. So you can see that, there's that territorial, the old Bronx machine rearing its head in a subtle way. But he didn't really do de Blasio any favors, and I don't think there's any real love for de Blasio among Hasty and the fellow Bronx machine people.
I keep saying to the Cuomoites, you know, what is Andrew doing continuing this non-productive fight with the mayor? Now, the mayor is getting all kinds of problems. Attorneys looking at him and everything else during this thing, but it looks like Andrew is bullying the guy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, and that's been a puzzle to a lot of us. We're not sure where this bad blood started, but it's there, and I don't expect it to go away anytime soon. But it's, you know, a lot of it started over school spending a couple years ago, over pre-K, and I would argue that some of it comes down to budgetary items too, where the mayor of New York City is always going to push for more programs and more spending and more pre-K. Cuomo has had a pretty good sense of fiscal discipline in New York State.
Well, in the beginning, especially. Now I think he's sort of giving it up.
Yeah, well, he's giving it out because there's money this year. There's bank settlements.
Also because he was considered to be a bit of a centrist, right-wing Democrat.
Yeah.
And he needed to convince people that he was with them, especially in the year of Bernie.
Yes, he has moved to the left, no question about it. But when you think about it, $15 an hour minimum wage, what's that going to cost the state? That's going to cost businesses more than the state. So if you look at the way he's run his budget and through the budget division, he's held a 2% growth cap per year among the state agencies and the spending. He shifts money around as needed, but he still has been fairly conservative, I'd say, at least compared to de Blasio. And well, I suspect that's part of this.
When he's giving the money back to the kids.
That, to the schools.
That does show a certain amount of largesse because he's been blamed for a long time for hurting the various schools in the state.
That's been a theme with all the school districts in 2008. You know, there was the financial crash, state aid was cut, and they didn't recover that until this year.
And also the tax cap that the governor put on that localities just couldn't find.
Yeah, they don't like it. But, you know, I got to say, they're never going to like it. You know, whether it's 2% or 4% or 0.5%, localities, schools, towns, they're not going to like a tax cap. So, I think that's part of the process.
Okay, so now we see Secretary Clinton, I want to spend a few moments on this, running for president. And we see Donald Trump, another New Yorker, running for president. What does this mean to New York?
The thing that I find fascinating, and I've written a little bit about this, is that I think it could have some impacts on the state Senate, the down ballot tickets. Obviously, there's been a lot written about how The Republicans in Congress and the Senate are now worried if there's an anti-Trump backlash, they could lose control or really get dented in their majorities. It could have some impact in the state Senate. I'm not sure how much. It really goes district by district. I suspect that a Trump candidacy will help the Senate Republicans in their traditional stronghold in western New York and upstate New York, where he's strong. Trump is tied to Carl Paladino, who remains popular. He's the guy, if you remember, who ran against Cuomo and basically got his rear end handed to him. But they love him in Buffalo, and he's sort of Trump light. He talks, you know, he makes all these outlandish statements. At the convention, he said, "I want to come in and clean up Albany with a baseball bat." And so I think that a Trump candidacy will help the Republicans in like the Panepinto seat. There's an open seat coming up in a Senate seat in western New York, now held by a Democrat. It could flip back Republican. There could be some, he could help some of the candidates, I'm not sure, but Long Island and the Mid-Hudson Valley.
Well, let's assume.
Because Trump does well in some areas of Long Island.
Sure.
And New York City is going to be deep blue Democratic no matter what. So the reason this is interesting is because the Senate is so closely divided between Republicans and Democrats.
Okay, but Rick Garland, even if the Democrats win the Senate, there's always this sort of secret caveat that they're not really going to have the power because there are five Democrats
That's correct.
Who have yep. been selling out to the Republicans.
Right. They need
Is there a better word than selling out?
Well, you can put it that way. There's a, you know, the Republicans now have, I think it's a one seat clear, genuine majority of numbers, but they have, actually they have six. They have Simca Felder, who's a Brooklyn Democrat, but he caucuses with the Republicans, yes. and he just says, "I'm going to go with whoever can bring home the most for my district."
I doubt that guy's going to ever go with the Democrats. I think his bet is made.
Well, if it flips back to the Democrats, I don't know. He's probably a social conservative. He comes from the Orthodox community, so that would be an issue. But the IDC, the Independent Democratic Caucus Conference, I call them
the traitors.
Well, yeah. That's what a lot of the Senate Dems call them, too. They were a group of five, mostly moderate, somewhat suburban, but not all, you know, Brooks, Staten Island, parts of the Bronx, upstate Democrats. They were very unhappy with the way things were going back in 2009, and things were a real mess then. It was a train wreck. There's no other way to describe it. They also weren't getting what they wanted, so they peeled off. And now they now side with the Republicans.
If Andrew Cuomo says to them, "You guys get back where you belong," they have to go, don't they?
They might try to go if he told them that, but the question is, will the Senate Democrats take them back?
This is something you have to understand.
Yeah. The Senate Democrats and Cuomo have no relationship. They don't talk to each other. They're just in separate spheres right now.
They're still furious that Cuomo helped get those other guys over to the Republican side.
And there continues to be a lot of bad blood among a lot of the mainline, mainstream Senate Dems against the IDC. There are still people that say, "No, we're not taking you back. We're still upset at you. We're not going to." Now, when it comes to taking over control of the Senate, though, the bad blood might be overcome. I don't know. Yeah. We'll have to see.
Okay, I only got a minute, but I want to ask you, Rick Garland, you've done a great job today. We appreciate it. Whether or not there is a sense of, as a reporter covering the legislature, more or less transparency than there used to be?
I'd say I don't really think there's any more. I think there's more barrage of information because of Twitter web and everything's out there. And which is a good thing. I mean, now I can put a document, a court decision, I can write about it, but I can just post it online. So that's a little bit more transparency, but that's not because the lawmakers have made it more transparent. That's because of technology has allowed us to be more transparent.
We are out of time. Our guest has been Rick Garland. Rick, you are terrific. Capital reporter for the Albany Times-Union. We very much appreciate your joining us. We hope you'll come back again.
You bet.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.